We're good. So thank you to the Stadrikis, to Mirah, for hosting tonight. That's so nice. And for Mercedes for bringing it together, for Shlomo also. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to discuss a few rabbinic personalities, but not to give an autobiography, although I will for about 2 minutes, just because I think it's important to give some context to it, but to use the teaching of each rabbinical figure that we'll be discussing over the next couple months and try and figure out their like world view on different issues. I don't know if we're actually going to get through all of them. We'll see how far we can get. So the first person then, tonight's topic is Rabbi Shimon Shmuel Hirsch. So full disclosure, my undergraduate thesis at York University was actually in Rabbi Shimon Shmuel Hirsch.
So cool.
Which was pretty cool, yes. So we go way back, you know, if you know what I'm saying. Now, Rabbi Shimon Shmuel Hirsch it's interesting. In certain ways, he actually became even more famous after he passed away, in the sense that he's used a lot when we grapple with many contemporary issues. At the time, he was like revolutionary, and now it's like, oh yeah, come on, it's just reverse, you know? And you'll see what I mean by that in a few minutes. So first of all, a little bit of background about him. His first Rebbe, which you probably not have heard of, was Rabbi Chacham Yitzchak Bernays. But more importantly, he was a student of Rav Yaakov Ettinger, who wrote a very famous comment in the Gemara called Aruch Lener. What's fascinating with the commentary on Aruch Lener is a very creative commentary on the Gemara, trying to figure out really a tremendous analytical understanding of the Talmud. So that was part of Rav Hirsch's background, including, and this was revolutionary for the time, in the 19th century, was he also went to the University of Bonn. What happened was his first position in the rabbinate was in Oldenburg. That's where he wrote two famous books called The 19 Letters and Choreb. So the 19 Letters, you might have seen it. Actually, I meant to print a copy of it, and I forgot. It's a thin green book, which is 19 letters. Now, these are made up. These are fictitious letters. He kind of wrote it, people say, based on like, you know, the famous book, The Kuzari, right? Where you have which is Rabbi Halevi having this discussion about Judaism with, so this, it's actually letters back and forth between a student and a teacher called The 19 Letters. So basically, the student asks questions, and then they're like hashkafic contemporary issues of the time, and the rabbi responding, which is basically what first. Now, he intended to take this and make it into a 600-page book, but he never got around to it. So it's 19 letters. Every letter is 10 pages or so, 5 pages. I mean, they're still pretty long, right? You know, especially like who writes letters today, anyways, right? But you know, this was an abridged version. He intended to make each one into a chapter. And Chorev, which is super famous, he basically goes through all the mitzvot, and he tries to rationalize them and categorizes them, and we'll touch on that if we have time a little bit later as well. So those are his two books that he wrote then. Then he moves to Frankfurt. He like bounces around a few places. The last 30 years of his life is in Frankfurt, where he writes his commentary on the Chumash, Tehillim, the Siddur, and many different essays. And he sees himself as defending Orthodox traditional Judaism, Reform Judaism. He's in Germany, right? So he's in Western Europe. Western Europe is almost completely assimilated, right? Tremendous, that's the strength, that's really the hotbed of Reform Judaism. And Orthodoxy is like ridiculed and mocked. And he tries to give it a sense of dignity. And his pirush in the Torah is to show how insightful, how relevant, contemporary, and this is very important, he needs to defend it grammatically. Because there's an attack against the Chumash that, their Ivrit, their grammar is wrong and poor, and Rav Hirsch comes to defend it, to say, no, this verb is chosen, or this specific word is chosen because it has this meaning, and that's actually a better interpretation. He spends a lot of time, not outwardly, you don't realize he's doing it, but that's really what he's trying to do. He's out to defend Judaism against the Reform world in the 19th century, and he wants it with a sense of dignity. He was a very, you know, he wore like the top hat, the nice suit. He walked around showing that, as opposed to Eastern European Jewry was like Poland, Lithuania, the shtetl, like, you know, the shirts out, the whatever, right? He was a very different type of Judaism. Now, Eastern European rabbis didn't always get along with Rabbi Hirsch because they saw him as too accommodating to the secular world. But again, Rav Hirsch was in a totally different climate and a totally different world, and he tried to bring a sense of majesty and chashivas and dignity to Frumkeit, which was seen and ridiculed by most Jews and non-Jews at the time. Yeah.
One of my friends last year did a project, kind of like she copied the idea of the 19 letters, and she did it for like one of the classes. It was like a hashkafa thing between a girl that was like a from girl and then a girl that like wanted to like find out more about Judaism or whatever. And it was really interesting how she like totally like made up this whole story about how like these two girls were like writing back to each other back and forth for like. It took her like a really long time.
Right.
Obviously, it was like a lot of letters, but it was
so
really
cool. That's right. So it's interesting because this modality, it's, the truth is, Rabbi Sacks does the same thing. Rabbi Sacks also creates letters called, what are they called? Contemporary letter? This has been borrowed by many people. I don't even know. I'm assuming it's all kind of based on the Kuzari in certain ways, of like going back and forth, having a dialogue, right, discussion. Sometimes.
There's an amazing book called Letters to Talia, which is like, it's one of my favorites. It's also like that kind of thing. It's doing like a religious boy and a girl who lives like on kibbutz in Israel. And the boy, it's so good.
And they go back and forth?
It's amazing. My hand, but I never read it.
It's what's it called? Letters to Talia? I never heard it before.
It's like a really good
book. Everyone's obsessed with it.
It's really good.
What's the one with letters? They wrote back content. There's two of them. We actually handed it out to every student.
Yeah,
Letters to the Next Generation. There you go. Letters to the Next
Generation.
Yeah. Oh. He has two versions. It's a PDF. It's for free online. One is Letters to the Next Generation, and then he wrote another one a few years later called Letters to the Next Generation 2. The first one is, I think, written specifically, here you go, in the year 2009, based around messages for Yom Kippur themed. And they wrote another one in 2011. So what is that? 2 years later, with like different themes. So... yeah, we also, again, very similar idea of like different Hashkafah issues. And that's going to be really important because you're going to see what's important to Rav Hirsch, you know, like what's like the hot issue topic, right, of the 19th century. Some which are totally relevant today, like they're not even, and some which are very much, you know, relevant. So let's take a look. So I tried to break it down into different issues. And each one, oh, do me a favor, can I get a chumash? And each one I tried to. Anything. No, like Chamashi Chamashi otherwise, so much fun. Thank you. And what I wanted to do was take a pasuk and see what he learns from it. Thank you. Okay, let's take a look. So I'm going to read you. Here's the pasuk. I'm going to read you the Hebrew. You have like a regular Chamashi? Do you have like a regular chumash? No?
Yeah.
So it's just too much, like, I can't. Like, it's too much.
I started using sitter like that, like, and, it's so disorienting. It's like a whole different
can't
thing.
Can't do it. Some people have a hard time trying to daven out of the Koran sitter, because it's like two, it's like different. You daven out of a certain sitter your whole life, it's very hard to change.
You don't like it? Yeah, you either like it or you don't.
Yeah. Love it. I've been using the same sitter. For about 20 years, and if it dies, I just buy the exact same one. I just can't.
You don't like, I like switching it up.
I know, I can't do it. Okay, are you ready? I'm going to read you the pasuk again in Hebrew. Okay, here we go, you ready? So here's the pasuk. The pasuk is as follows, and you're quite familiar with this. Okay, Vayitzmach Hashem Elokim min hadama, kol eitz nechmad lemar'eh, v'tov lema'achal. So in English, pleasant to the eye and good to eat. Now, what's interesting is, right? Look at the way these trees are described. Look at the emphasis in the Chumash. What's the term? Well, if you want to describe a tree, right? Look how it is. Nechmad lemar'eh. That's a cute tree you got there, right? Who's supposed to have it? Nechmad lemar'eh. Pleasant. V'tov lemachal. I get tov lemachal. I mean, if it's a fruit tree, I get tov lemachal. But why are you telling me nechmad lemar'eh? Why is the Torah going out of its way to highlight aesthetics? Right? You don't need to tell me that. You want to tell me it's especially, because remember, in Gan Eden, what did humans eat? Humans only ate fruit. Animals ate vegetables. Right? So you want to tell me it's functional. Okay, so tell me that there's food. But don't tell, why are you describing Nechma Lamareh? Says Rav Hirsch, Valuing beauty raises man above the animal kingdom and moves him closer to ethical goals. He sees beauty as a way. He says, look, no animal appreciates beauty. No animal looks at a sunset and goes, wow, what a sunset. What a painting of, you know, pouring over. Interesting, by the way, what's interesting about that picture over there, there's only one copy, which was very common, right? You couldn't afford, right? You couldn't afford many copies of a book, right? You had one copy. That was a typical view. I guarantee you those other books that are lying around there, those far, are just probably different ones, right? So we live in the printing press era or the wealthy era where, you know, what's a book, right? It's nothing. It's pages. It's easy to do. We print up pages, you discard them moments later, right? It's nothing for us. But binding was very, very expensive. But beauty was something, says Rav Hirsch, that the Chumash emphasized, because that distinguishes humans from animals. It's a sense of majesty. Now remember Rav Hirsch? Remember what he's doing? Let's go back. 19th century, Germany, aesthetics, beauty. Don't tell me that Yiddishkeit is like zhlobi and disgusting and prim. No. But it's, and he connects beauty and ethics. He says, the ethical way you behave, there's a sense of majesty and beauty. This is the Chumash emphasizes it, right? And that's one way to distinguish humans from animals, is that we care about beauty. No dog says, I don't look so good today, right? Bad hair day. Well, I don't even say that anymore. But, you know, some people say, bad. They don't talk like that, animals, right? They're not self-aware of how they look and how they appear, whereas the Chumash went out of its way about appearance. And any time there's, for example, and he goes and refers to pieces in many different places. For example, the Mishkan, this is Parsha, right? Beauty. You don't need anything to go for, right? You don't need it. No. There's something about, and next is Parsha, right? The Bidei Kahuna. Again, majesty and beauty in Avodas Hashem and in Yiddishkeit was something Rav Hirsch said is emphasized in the Chumash as an important value. Okay? So that was something that he saw as something of was necessary. Now, and in fact, he even writes, one of his kids' names, Noah, one of his kids' name is Yafes. So there's a lot to talk about here, which I'm not going to, this is a bit too off topic. But it even says, when it comes to Noach, right? Ish tzadik tonya b'dorasav, es alokim hisalech Noach, where he even writes, describing Noach, and he says here, art lifts mankind above base sensuality. Morality remains the essential criterion for the good life. He says, listen, then the day morality is way more important. Don't get me wrong. It's not about beauty. But he says, we can enhance the ethical and the moral by focusing on the beauty. Now, and that's what he says here. It's subordinate, right? It remains subordinate. Beauty is subordinate to ethics. And he says, Shem and Yafes made two contributions to human culture. The Jews carried the message of shame, while Greece contributed the geese of Yafes. And we know, when we talk about beauty, it's where's the role of beauty, where's the role of Torah? So it says, where should beauty be? Yishkon ba'ole yaftalukim yafet v'yishkon ba'ole shem. That yafet, beauty, has value only if it's dwelling in the house of of shame. Right? And he says that's the relationship between beauty and between ethics. Between yaftalukim yafet, something of beauty, and shame, which is the Jewish tradition, you need to have beauty in one place. Beauty for the sake of beauty, he would not think would be valuable, but needs to dwell in a place of shame, in the place of Torah, in the place of the Mishkan. And one of the proofs that Rav Hirsch, because he also wrote a commentary on Perkei Avos, so look what he says here. Look at this Mishnah. This Mishnah is from Avos, Rabbi Shimon Omer. Hamhalech baderech v'shoneh. Person is traveling. V'shoneh means they are, they're learning. Umafsik b'mishnah so, he stops learning, and he says, ooh, ma ne'eh ilan zeh. Look how beautiful that tree is. Ma ne'eh nir zeh. Look how wonderful that field is. Ma la'alav ha'kasuv ki'ilu mischayev b'nafsha. Oh my goodness. They write about him as if basically they forfeited their life. Wait a second. I'm walking. I'm learning. I stop my learning. And I pause to comment about a tree. And I say, wow, what a nice tree. What a nice field. A person, the Mishnah says, forfeits their life. So one way to understand this is very simple. You're learning. Why are you looking at trees for? Focus on your learning, says the Mishnah. Why are you commenting on the beauty of a tree? Or beauty, focus on your learning. Don't stop learning because of a tree. It says the first no. He who, while studying, does not become aware of this higher beauty of God's teaching, so that he will break off his sacred work to exclaim over the beauty of nature, is as if he had sinned against his own soul, or rather, as if he forfeited his own soul. For, despite his beauty, he thus shows that he has not come to understand the dignity and beauty of a human soul that is guided and enlightened by the Spirit of God, and beauty and dignity that surpasses all earthly beauty by far. If you look at it, that your learning is X, and the beauty is Y, and they're not connected, that's why you forfeit your soul. Rav Hirsch says you have to see it. He says, I'm not stopping my learning, right? It's a continuation and appreciation of God's world, because it recognizes God's world. If you just look at a tree or a field and you say, nice tree, nice field, way to go, nature, that would be problematic. But if you view it and you see your learning, first of all, this guy's traveling, so he's not really in a base measures anyways, right? And if you sever your learning, if you sever the way you're learning and the natural world around you as two distinct things, as polar opposites, then that is when you forfeit your life. You have to see, and this is Rav Hirsch's thing, that you have to look at beauty as something which is part of God's world. And that, by the way, wasn't so simple. To talk about beauty in the 20th century, in many circles, was almost anti-religious, right? Arts. Museum, right? You don't do those things. That's not for, that's for the secular world. That's for the Reformed Jew, not for the Talmudic Jew. So in many ways, Rav Hirsch was saying things which was going against definitely Eastern European Jewish thought. And because of that, his shul in Germany looked like the Bayit. There's a choir. It had nice pews, nice rows. By the way, you should know. We don't realize this. If you had a shul in Poland that looked like the Bayit, it was a Reformed temple. Right? You couldn't... That the Reform had the balcony. The Reform had those nice rows and pews. That was a church. That's not a shul. That's the way a church looked.
Are there some people who still won't do that?
So that's why classic Sephardi shuls don't look like that.
Mashallah.
Right, okay. That's a classic, right?
Mashallah
looks like a mosque. Right? Classic mosque. Right? Interesting. So interesting. I don't want to get into different configurations for synagogues. But you'll notice there are certain styles. For example, you'll never see Ashkenazi circular shul, but you will for Sephardi.
Circular.
You ever seen Sephardi shuls? They sit along the edges in a circle.
Shirshman's
a little circular.
Yeah, I've seen that type of shul.
But circular shuls was much more found in the Spanish tradition, because in the Christendom, the Christian world, they're much more rectangular-like.
In Poland, though, like, if you go, they do have some shuls with balconies in it.
Yeah, yeah. I know Poland is Shepinian Jews. Right? They became very much adopted to that. But again, you don't have the ambiance of the beautiful synagogue. You know, Polish shuls were not known for the beauty. They're very simple. First of all, they had no money. So they're not spending it on a shul, right? Whereas the Germanic shuls needed to... Again, I hate to say it, but it's marketing. You needed to make a place appealing. They wouldn't go down the block to a church. So what did the Reform... The Reform Temple was beautiful. You ever go to Poland? You ever see the Reform Temple in Poland, in Krakow? You ever... No,
you
might have... Right? So it was this beautiful synagogue. Why? Because they wanted the people to come to the Reform Temple, not come to the church. Right? So you have to kind of compete. It's marketing. Right? So in many ways, Rav Hirsch, the synagogues looked beautiful. There was a sense of aesthetic, you know, pleasing. They had a choir, right? I have a choir. Choirs. It was totally Christian. We had choirs in a shul, right? Now, people like choirs. They like choirs. They have different tastes, right? But they did. Having a choir was unheard of in Eastern European synagogue shul. Having a choir didn't happen. Okay. The next thing, which I think is really fascinating, is his approach to what's called egalitarianism. Now, this is not men and women at all. That was not an issue at all in those days, although a little bit, which maybe I'll touch on a little bit later. But what he had a very important value, and his value was everyone can learn Torah. That's even by egalitarianism, right? I mean, everyone has an opportunity to learn. And so much so that he downplays, in certain times, Moshe Rabbeinu. Because they want to make Moshe a regular human. Might have been special and unique. For example, the Chumash, just a few weeks ago we read, it says, it lists a genealogy. Right before Moshe and Aaron appear before Paro, the Chumash goes on a very odd tangent and writes about the lineage of Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? That's, take a look there. It says, in Shemot, in Perek Vav, all of a sudden it lists. So there's a thing in Psukim, right? Votseti, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vigachti, Vavesi. All of a sudden, emotion are about to go, right? Hashem tells Moshe, "Bode the barrel part of Mitzrayim," right? Command them. All of a sudden, stop. And the Chumash goes on a tangent and says, "Ela Rashi Beit Avotam." These are the heads of the household: Bnei Reuven, Bechor Yisrael, Chanoch, Ela Shmuel, Bnei Levi. But why do you listen to genealogy for? Right? What is the genealogy for? Says reverse. The Torah outlines the genealogies of the tribes of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi to show humanity of these great leaders. They have cousins. They have uncles. And clearly this is against Christianity. Right? Jesus? What do you mean? Immaculate Conception? He doesn't have a family. He's above a family. He's a deity. He's like a god. Says Rav Hirsch, Moshe Rabbeinu has cousins. He's family. He's a human being. Right? So that's why it's listening to genealogy. Before the great Moshe takes Bnei Israel, or assists, I should say. I can't say takes Bnei. Hashem takes Bnei Israel. Assists in taking up Bnei Israel. The Torah says, stop. Let me tell you who Moshe was. He had a family. Right? Okay. He might divorce his wife. Is he, right? But nonetheless, you should know that he has Mishpacha. Right? He's not this. And so in many ways, he refers to his commentary, will also attack Christianity. And this is definitely, for sure, everyone says this is an example of it. This is a great vort. It's next week's parsha. So if you want, you can save this for Torah for next week. Rav Hirsch says, and again, the truth is, it's not even Rav Hirsch. He actually quotes the Gemara. Next week's parsha talks about the Shemen Zayis, talks about the Ner Tamid. So look at the language. So I ask you a question, ladies. Who should light the Ner Tamid? Whose mitzvah is it? Take a look. Vata. Titzave et b'nei yisov v'chuelecha Shemen Zayis zach. Kasis lamor lelos Ner Tamid. Right? Command. By the way, this is the parsha that Moshe's name is not mentioned. Right? Command Ben Israel, take Shemen Zayit Zach, that pure olive oil, right? And use it in order to kindle this eternal lights. Where are you going to do this? Bo Moed, Chuzah Parochas, Asher Leidus, Yeruch Oso, Aaron, Uvanav, Mi'arav, Adbogeth, Ne'ashem, Chukas, Salam, Dorosam, Meis Ben Israel. And you're going to place this in the tent of meeting, outside the Parochas, remember the testimony, that's referring to the Luchos. Aaron and his children make sure these lights are kindling from the night until the morning forever. Now, what would you say? This is looked upon as the light, often understood in the Gemara as Torah, right? Light and kindling and a near. So who's obligated to do it? Who's the only person that could light these lights? Who's obligated to light the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, or this time the Mishkan? Who's obligated to do it? What does the Pesukim seem to imply? It appears it's a Kohen. Not true. This mitzvah actually can be done by the Kohen, but even a Zar. The Gemara says anybody can light the menorah. It's a mitzvah for the Kohen to do it, but anyone can do it. It says, well, first, why? Why specifically, that's not true, but it comes to offering the daily sacrifice, why this lighting the menorah, which is done every night, you'd think it should be done by the Kohen. After all, it appears to be a very priestly job. It says, reverse, since the menorah is connected to the Torah in terms of its light, and it illuminates, and it provides brightness, he says, the purpose of the teacher of Torah is to render himself superfluous. The priest should not keep the commoner in a situation of ongoing independence. Right? The job of a teacher is to teach. Not just to teach students how to learn independently. And therefore, it's a Gemara, right? The Gemara says that anyone could do the menorah. Rav Hirsch sees this as a very powerful message to the educator, to the rabbi, to the scholar, to the leader. Don't have your students rely on you. Make them become independent. Give it over to them to do, right? Have them light the menorah. Have them write their own letters to their own generation. Right, that is a value. And again, Rav Hirsch is saying, anyone, right? Anyone can do it. It's not just for the special individuals. And last but not least, when Eldad Umedad, we know that Moshe gave over the 70 leaders also a sense of prophecy, nevuah, to help Moshe, right? And Rav Hirsch says this was looked upon as a positive thing to help Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe says, Yeshua is very upset. And Moshe says, let everybody become a Navi. More Navi, the better. Why not? Okay. those are a few areas. Let's jump to the notion of sinfulness. So this comes up a lot in the modern era as well. Are human beings born evil? Or are they born good? Or are they neutral? Like tabula rasa. This is a big ashkafa question. This is the big machloket in Chassidut. This is a major, major, major topic between Jewish scholars and the Gemara. So you could, very difficult topic, very extensive. In the modern era, it's also battled out by John Locke and the battle between Mill, John Stuart Mill, and even the contemporary philosophers, not so contemporary philosophers, deal with the nature, what's the nature of a human being. Rav Hirsch had a very strong approach. Rav Hirsch, in many ways, this is very different than your classic European approach in the 19th century. It's much more similar to the Hasidic approach, and that is human beings have a nature towards goodness. And he proves it, and anywhere where in the Torah where it might appear to counter his argument, he spends a very long time in his commentary defending his position. Okay? Let me give you a couple of examples. One, Uladam Amar. This is after the Gan Eden. Because you listen to your wife, that you ate from the fruit that your wife gave you, and I command you not to eat from it. Arura hadama bavuracha, the ground is cursed because of you. With great pain you will eat. Says Rav Hirsch, who gets cursed? Who gets cursed? The ground? No, that is true. Who gets cursed in this pasuk? The ground. Adam doesn't get cursed. And by the way, does the woman get cursed? But the woman, it just says, Elisha Amar, Harbe Arbe, Itzvonech, Heronech, Vesilivanim. There's no word by curse. There are two things that get cursed. The Nachash gets cursed and the ground gets cursed. That's it. And because of that, says Rav Hirsch, human beings don't get cursed. Human beings are above the curse. They are not destined towards evil. The ground is brutal. That's nature. The animal kingdom devours. The lion devours the cheetah. The lion devours the gazette in the field. The ground is cursed. The ground by itself, you don't plant anything, nothing grows. When you plant things, you're lucky if things grow. The ground is cursed. You have to work very hard to produce blessing from the ground. The animal kingdom is brutal, evil, disgusting, survival of the fittest. Might is right. It says, first, human beings don't function that way. Human beings have a tendency towards goodness, towards understanding, towards respect, towards majesty, right? This is what Rav Hirsch says, the ground gets cursed, the nachash gets cursed, people do not get cursed. People are above the sense of a curse, right? I could talk with this for a lot longer, but he has, I'll just show you the last quote there. Rav Hirsch says, woe to one who thinks that the average child is evil. This has major implications. He wrote a whole essay on education. Right? On his contemporary writings, as you know that. And he writes a whole thing on education. He says, teachers have to realize that in front of them are pupils who have tremendous potential and goodness, and it's the responsibility of the educator, the machanech, the machanechet, to bring out the goodness of a child. But for a teacher to walk in and say, I got bed students, and they're annoying, and they're so spoiled, and they're so rotten, and all they care about is technology, it's not your job. Your job is the exact opposite. Your job is to bring out the goodness that is latent in every single child. And he speaks about that. So again, that's what I'm saying. We're talking about that when his view of the world impacts many, many different areas. Let's talk about sacrifices. So three things I want to point out. Number one, Rav Hirsch views korbanos as a way of elevating the human being. Meaning, what's the most important korban for Rav Hirsch? So Rav Hirsch says the most important korban is the shlamim. Let me explain. There are three types of major korbanot that exist. Number one is called the chatat. Chatat is brought when you sin. That's why it's called the sin offering, right? Next, the next major type of korban is an ola. What happens to an ola? Is completely consumed. The owners don't eat. Certain olos, the Kohen eats, but the owner does not partake. A shalamim is eaten by the Mizbeach, which is like God. The Kohen eats, and the person who brings it eats. Rav Hirsch highlights and he says, take a look at Har Sinai. When Bnei Yisrael bring korbanot, at the end of Har Sinai, they bring olot and they bring shlamim. Olot and shlamim represent a person who has come close to God, right? And not in a sense of fear, but in a sense of awe and love. Because the assumption is, you eat together, there's a sense of shlamim, you're shalem, you're mushlam, we want to partake together, let's have a meal together. Right? And what's interesting was you had to eat the shlamim, you had a very short time period to eat all the food. So you invite your family over. That's why, for example, Meiser Sheni, same idea. Meiser Sheni was a tithe that you had to eat in Yerushalayim. There's no way you could eat it all. So you invite your friends. An example, by the way, of a mini shlamim is what we call today a toda. A toda, a korban toda, is you'd come, something good happened to you. So toda is really a type of shlamim. What does that mean? Do you have any idea how many breads you brought? A korban toda is 24 breads. Some of them were, I apologize, dipped in oil. Actually, many of them were dipped in oil, and they were flour, and they were classic breads. Some were kosher Pesach, some were chametz, which, by the way,
breads.
What?
It could just be like a little bread.
No, they're big breads. They're like 32 or something, flour, cups worth of flour. They're gigantic, tons of breads. And you had to eat them in 2 days. In a big bowl. A big animal. You can't eat that in 24 hours. So now you appreciate the source of a kiddush. The reason why people get an aliyah and they make a bracha called. People ever heard that people get called up to the Torah, make a Torah, and they make a bracha called to thank for a good thing that happened to them? You ever heard that before? Never seen that before? Right? People get called up to the Torah and they want to bring, they had a baby, right? Or they were in a car accident and they survived, right? So they're called to the Torah, and they make a special bracha to thank God for what happened to them. So that goes back to the times of Beit HaMikdash, the Divrei Korban Toda. Right? Now, the concept of Kiddush comes from the same place. Why? Because you give, in the times of Beit HaMikdash, you'd bring tons of food as a korban, as a Thanksgiving offering. But you couldn't eat it all in one day. You can't eat 24 loaves of bread or bread. It's impossible. So you invited your friends to come with you. Your friend's like, oh, why are you eating? Why are you making Kiddush? The answer is, oh, God did something good to me. God saved me. God helped me. I had a baby. I had a child. I was saved in a car accident. I was sick and I was healed. So that's the idea of, that's where it comes from. Kiddush really comes from. It's an old minhag, clearly coming from the Beit HaMikdash, where you couldn't eat all the food yourself, so you had to invite your friends. Your friends are like, dude, what's the reason why you're having all this food? Let me tell you what God, the goodness that God bestowed upon me and my family.
Right? You need 10 men to bench gomel.
Right, and that's why you need to bench. That's exactly where the gomel comes from, right? This is the gomel. This is what you're called up to do. And that's why you don't say mizmor l'toda on Pesach, or on Erev Pesach. Why? Because it consisted of certain loaves that were chametz. Therefore, there were no korban todas that were brought from Erev Pesach until the end of Yom Tov, because some of it was chametz. So if you can't bring, it's all or nothing. So therefore, there's no korban todah that were brought. And you can't bring korban todah on a Yom Tov or Shabbos because it's a voluntary offering. And you can't bring voluntary offerings on Shabbos Yom Tov. Only obligatory offerings were allowed to be brought. Right? So again, Rav Hirsch said, that's the paradynamic type of korban, is a korban shlamim. Like a Meiser Sheni, like a korban, a gomel, right? Where you're sharing and you're eating and you're partaking, because Rav Hirsch emphasizes over and over and over again the enjoyment, the simcha, what it means to be a Jew. And in fact, there's a famous machloket at the end of the Nazir. What's a Nazir? A Nazir is a person who
doesn't
cut their hair. Can Nazir be a woman? Of course. Pasuk says, Isha Isha, Ki Yazir Nazir Hashem. Rav Shachter used to ask this to get into the YU smicha program. He said, because when we become a Nazir, oh, chas v'shalas, you're not in, you can't be a chumash. If you don't have a positive chumash, how are you going to become a rabbi? Right? So the Torah says that a man or woman can take it on for either 30 days or a longer period of time. Shimshon was already a Nazir from the time he bet, the time he was born. So it was Yirmiyahu, right? But most people come a Nazir, I'm a Nazir for 30 days, 6 months, a year. So you avoid all grape products and
haircuts
and dead bodies. You basically become a mini Kohen. At the end of your time period, 30 days, 6 months, whatever it is, you bring a Korban Chatat. Famous machloket, the Ramban and the Rambam. Why bring a Korban Chatat? What sin did you do? You didn't sin. The Ramban says, yeah, you did sin. You should be a Nazir your entire life. You should avoid these things that regular people do. says the Rambam the exact opposite. You bring Korban Chatat because you think you have to take yourself away from the physical world to become holier. That's a sin. You bring Korban Chatat. Says Rav Hirsch, holds by the Rambam. And he says, and he quotes the Rambam in his commentary on Chumash, and I brought you what it says here, and says, well, I'll quote you the Rambam, because Rav Hirsch brings with it, and I even say so at the end, Rav Hirsch sides with the Rambam. Shema Yomar Adam Huel V'ha Kina V'Tava V'Kavod. A person might say that jealousy, desire, and honor, these are bad things. Because of the things you remove yourself from the world. I'm going to separate myself from all these things. I will become an extremist. And I will go to the opposite end of the spectrum when it comes to honor, when it comes to desire, when it comes to jealousy. Ad shelo yochal basar, I won't eat meat. V'lo yishta yarn, I won't drink any wine. V'lo yisa yisha, I won't get married. V'lo yishiv b'dirah ne'a, I don't want to live in a nice apartment. V'lo yilbash mabushin, I won't even wear nice clothing. Ela hasak v'atzemer hakashal, I'll walk around with like sackcloths and hard wool. Which sounds really uncomfortable. V'yasebehem, like the kone of the kochavim. By the way, you should know, this is also a knock against Christians. Think about the classic monastery. You ever seen a classic monastery? Mm-hmm. Up on a hilltop, simple, basic, removed from society. Right? That was very Christian. Christians saw themselves as removing themselves from the world. That's why they didn't get married. Right? That's the ideal. Right? Celibacy is an ideal in the Christian world. That's very much not the case in the Jewish world. And Rav Hirsch, here's the Rambam in a second, right? Is going to quote the Rambam a lot, and the view of trying to remove yourself from the physical world is going to be something which Rav Hirsch is going to say, based on the Rambam, very anti-Jewish. Okay? And look at the Rambam. Gam ze derech ra'ahi. Says Rambam, this is terrible. Vasur. You cannot have this opinion, says the Rambam. Hamalach b'derech zo. If you go in this way, listen to this. Nikra chote. You're a sinner if you see yourself as removing yourself completely from the physical world. That's very Christian. That's very Catholic. And that was something which the Rambam and Rav Hirsch is not going to see favorable at all. You should know, in Eastern European Jewry, in the Hasidic world, piety very much placed an emphasis on aesthetics. Right? The Rebbes. Not modern day rebbes. The old rebbes lived very, very simple lives. Now, they didn't have many opportunity to have anything else, but their simplicity was something that was very Hasidic, right? Rebbes rarely had a whole, you know, today they do. Today they own like empires and fields, right? That wasn't the way they were hundreds of years ago, right? And what will be the Rambam's proof to this way of life? He quotes the life of a Nazir. Hare om. Arehu Omer bin Nazir v'kipir alav masher chata al nefesh. Amu chachamim. Because the Rambam is just quoting the Gemara. Uma ani Nazir shalo piresh elamina yagin tzirich kapara amunetzo mikol devar devar alach al kam v'kama. If a Nazir who separates himself and says, I'm not going to drink wine, has to bring a sin offering, how much more so would a person who says, I need to remove myself from so many of the physical world, the taivas that we live in, how much more so would they have to bring a sin offering? That's not the way the world works. And in fact, the Rambam concludes by saying, whoever takes on additional fast days is considered a evil person, because you don't. Al tzedek arbe. Don't be so frum. Don't be so righteous. There's enough fast days in the calendar. Don't take on more days. Very interesting. The Hasidic world added a tremendous amount of fast days to the calendar. Right? You know, these people would fast every Monday and every Thursday, right? And very, very two different outlooks. Both are grounded in many Jewish sources, right? The Shkafik, Machloket, right? Which one do you highlight? That was the opinion of the Rambam that Rav Hirsch very much sided with. And again, just to point out the mirrors. When they needed to build the kior in the Mishkan, the women brought their mirrors to donate. Famous Gemara. What was Moshe's response to all these mirrors? Mirrors? In the Mishkan, mirrors, beauty, gashmias, my hair, my makeup, forget it, said Moshe. Hashem said, no, these mirrors are beloved to me. The women use it to beautify themselves, to encourage the Jewish people to continue. The Rav Hirsch says, that's a very powerful message. Don't throw away the baby with the bathwater. There's something very powerful about mirrors and beauty. Yes, it can lead to terrible things, there's no question. But it doesn't have to be that way. It can be used as something of value, of kedusha, and of holiness. Okay, we only have 10 minutes. I'll focus on a couple things. Number one, philosophy. In many ways, Rav Hirsch was very similar to Rav Yehuda Halevi. He was anti-philosophy that didn't have a practical component to it. Right? All this philosophical jargon, and very much he was against the Rambam and Mor Nevuchim. Who needs to understand all these philosophical terminologies? They're irrelevant. They don't matter. What matters are Torah and mitzvot, and you're actually doing and accomplishing. That's what matters, and that's what our emphasis should be on. Judaism has no regard for the kind of speculation that does not aspire to contribute to active, productive life. We are warned against misconceiving our intellectual powers and probing into bottomless depths, no matter what glittering constructions and these such a quest may produce. He was not interested in philosophy, zig of philosophy. He was interested in philosophy that would help you become a better person, a better Jew, and that was important to him. And that's why he put such an emphasis on understanding the mitzvah. Because Rav Hirsch said, you need to understand why you do what you do. That has purpose and meaning. Right? But explain in the Torah, why does he use examples of anthropomorphism to say that God has a hand and an eye? That Rav Hirsch wasn't interested in. Right? Or the chariots, or the angels, or the spheres in the heavens, that was interesting to Rav Hirsch. Because that's Kabbalistic, it's not practical, real, not from Rav Hirsch's perspective, what actually had an impact. Because remember, again, he's focusing on how can I make Judaism more relevant and meaningful. That's what matters. That's what I need to hammer home. And he felt it was so compelling. It was so compelling, Judaism. He said that's what I needed to highlight. So this theology, right, for Rav Hirsch, was to talk about religion, didn't interest him. Didn't interest him at all. Metaphysics and the metaphysical attributes of God, nothing that he spent a lot of time on, and is very dismissive of those types of things. Now, just it's worthwhile noting, and I wish we could spend a lot of time on this, but we're not going to. Take a look at the categories. I first felt that every mitzvah fit into a category. Number one, they're called Torot. They're doctrines concerning God, the world, humanity, and Israel. What would be an example, do you think, of a Torah, on page 3.
Doctrine.
Like, a Torah would be a statement that pertains to it, or anything that would come from it. Well, number 2 is the easiest. Mishpatim. What's an example of Mishpatim? What?
Okay.
Right. Murder. Murder. Last is partial. Mishpatim. Anything pertaining to stealing or laws between an employer and employer or a shore, an animal. Right? We'll come back to number 1 if you can't think of one. What would be 3? Chukim. Justice towards plants, animals, and ourselves. This is not your classic way of understanding chukim. You have to, that's not Rafersh's motto. At all. Not at all. Tzar Balei Chaim, very good, would be considered a chok. For the reverse. Why Catalan? What's his proof? It's very complicated, which I'm like, it's just, that's why I wrote a 600-page book on it, right? Right? Very interesting. It's very counterintuitive in certain ways. But even ourselves, okay. 4, mitzvah is obligation to love all beings. So we'll do the easiest one, because the easiest one, Vavucha Kamocha, or anything tztaka related. We'll put there. Edut, symbolic acts that convey essential truths and lessons. I'll just tell you this because you'll never figure this out. A mezuzah. Mezuzah is an aid. It testifies to tefillin. It testifies to Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Right? Those things, that's called an edut. Avoda, or like tefillah, religious life, or anything Beit Midash or the Mishkan related. Okay, so Torah would be considered, right, something that connects. For example, saying Shema, believe it or not, I believe he put under the Torah because it concerns God, world, humanity, and Israel. Right? And that's B'nai Yisrael related. There's better examples. I just can't think of them right now.
What book is this?
Chorev. Oh. Chorev. I'll tell you, I hate to say this, there's a great book written by an English translation of Chorev, written by a judge from England, Diane Grunfeld or something. His introduction to that book is the best part of Chorev. It's better than Rav Hirsch's Chorev. Right? Because the way he summarized it, it's much more readable and manageable. The problem with Rav Hirsch was that he was German. The joke is that Germans got paid per letter, meaning they didn't know how to be concise. They wrote and wrote and wrote. The word concise and précis wasn't in their vocabulary. There's no such thing as shorter the better, the longer the better. The more verbose you were, the greater it was. So his commentaries go on and on and on, right? And first of all, every commentary read is a translation, because he wrote in German, which, by the way, was also a big deal. Who writes a parish in German? What, you're supposed to write a parish in the Torah in Hebrew, right? So he wrote. He wrote also in Hebrew, Tibetan. A lot of things that he did was actually in German. Just to end off, in the last 5 minutes that we have, he was not a Zionist. He did not place a large emphasis on Zionism at all, and he actually felt that the Jews should not take an active role in ending their exile. He felt that the Torah is more fundamental than the land of Israel. Not that the land of Israel doesn't play a role, obviously, because it could help keep the Torah, but the land of Israel, because interesting, 19th century Zionism was around, and he did not see himself as part of the Zionist movement, which is fascinating. Because here's a person who studies in university. Today we don't associate it that way, right? We generally associate Zionism with modernity, right? Generally speaking, Rav Hirsch was very much for studying university, the majesty of Judaism. Yet he was not a Zionist, right? Which is fascinating because again, it doesn't fit so much in the world that we live in today. The other thing which was fascinating was he was very controversial. It almost broke him. It was called I don't know if I'm pronouncing this word properly, it's called the Auschwitz controversy. The Auschwitz controversy was, in Germany, the question is, should the Orthodox community join the UGA Federation, or they split away from Federation and create their own Forum organization? That's the way to put it in modern context. Rav Hirsch led the anti-UGA camp, which is, again, very counterintuitive. Yet, the rabbis in Germany, who are, quote-unquote, for lack of a term, more yeshivish, were pro-remaining with the general camp. Again, very counter, doesn't fit, because you think Rav Hirsch was one who was for secular university, yet he felt that we need to create our own Jewish, for lack of a better term, federation, although it wouldn't have been that organized and complex, but that's the idea behind it. Yeah, and almost broke him.
So do you think the main reason that people with I feel like a lot of people view him as a more modern guy because of all the changes or new ideas he brought, not necessarily what he stood for?
People stand behind Rav Hirsch in many ways. He's going to coin a phrase called Torah in Derech Eretz, where people could relate to the fact that he made himself very much relatable to every human being. So that was very revolutionary, as opposed to, again, this is why his organizational perspective is so counterintuitive, because that wasn't what he did in life. In life, he's no, we need to show the world that we're meaningful and relevant, and we have what to offer and to impact. Yet, it doesn't mean we water down what we do. We don't come to their level, and that's what he felt we would be doing if we joined them in their organizations and connect to Zionism. Yet he believes in Torah in Derech Eretz, which, everyone can Torah in Derech Eretz, Torah Umadai, everyone kind of uses that Torah im something, but he was very much Derech Eretz for Rav Hirsch was dignity. Very much emphasized the dignity of the human being. Both their outlook in life and the positive nature of life, and that's why aesthetics and...
Does it feel like that sense of certain hashkafa, or he was his own thing?
He was actually his own thing, and in many ways, it's almost a failure. The reason why people say it's a failure is because, I wouldn't say a failure. He contributes to something and has a tremendous impact, but his hashkafa almost doesn't exist today. People will borrow aspects of it, which may be, by the way, maybe that's a sign of success. Right? Meaning, what he's able to do is his impact is that many people will quote him and use him, and you're going to see, I'll throw out four or five examples quickly, where people will use him, for example, in education. His view on education was revolutionary at the time, although today it's not revolutionary. It was 200 years ago, right? His outlook in many, you'll see four things, right now I'll tell you. Number one, on the Avos, we know there's a machlokes in commentaries on looking at the Avos and Imahos as super gods and super goddesses, whereas real people, Right? The Ramban says Avraham sinned. Some people say, no, 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 don't take that Avraham sinned as a sin, take it as a sin. Well, today there's tons of literature on how you understand the Avos Imahos. Yes, they're great people, but did they make mistakes? Rav Hirsch was one who didn't talk about the Avos Imahos as the superhuman. They were human, and he emphasized they're human because he felt that's more relatable. I mean, he felt he was right, right? But he felt it was much more relatable and much more meaningful. And it was what the Chumash said. Right? Agadot. I'll give you an example. Rav Hirsch says, you learn an Agadata in a Gemara or in a Medrash, don't take it literally, but take it seriously. Don't take, you know, that Moshe was this tall and all these Agadata, which seem very odd. Like what? You know, the famous one that everyone quotes, right? That the daughter of Paro went to get Moshe Rabbeinu, her hand stretched out, you know. No, no, what's the message behind that? Don't take that literally. So Rav Hirsch said, you got to, when the Medrash or the Gemara brings Agadatas, you got to understand what they're really meaning. Don't take it literally. Again, that came with a, science. Rav Hirsch was not scared of science at all, contradicting anything in Chumash or in the Gemara at all. He said, science is science, Chumash is Chumash, the Gemara is Gemara. He wasn't bothered by anything scientific knowledge, right? Chosenness, for example. He felt the Jewish people were chosen. Doesn't necessarily mean they're better. Felt that we have a responsibility, but to walk around saying that we're morally superior, he felt was problematic. Women, he was very much pro-women learning. Right? Which was way ahead of its time. And that coined the term, Torah and Derech Eretz, right? Derech Eretz, Kadma la Torah, that they have dignity and the way the person behaves. So, you know, and here, you know, I brought a few of his quotes. I'm not going to read all of them. But it's a real sense of trying to... He had this tremendous sense of humility, but a tremendous sense of conviction, where he said, if I'm able to get, quote-unquote, my way, I can have a tremendous impact to ensure the Torah, the nitzchiut of Torah, is going to last. But it's only if we look at it in this way. If we say that the Torah is, you know, the Evergadita is literal, and if we say that, you know, taking a look at something about science, he says, these things are going to ultimately destroy Judaism. And he never felt at all that he was bending, that he was minimizing. He said, no, this is exactly what the Chachamim and Chazal had in mind. I'm just highlighting this, and I'm bringing this to the forefront. And if people understood it and appreciated it, there would be no reform movement. They just don't understand. They don't appreciate what they have in front of them, and they're looking at it from, you know, misguided lenses. And that's what, so it's funny. In many ways, Rav Hirsch's success only comes 100 years later. He dies. He doesn't have a big following. He's a small shul in Germany. He's not one of the larger names in terms of the great tshuvos that he wrote, or right? So now he's become popular because he wrote a commentary on Chumash that's very accessible, that people really like, you know. Right, Feigenbaum is a big component of Rav Hirsch. I don't know if you used to. Do you remember that at all? No, right? You used to quote him all the time, right? Because Rav Hirsch makes the Chumash come to life. He literally brings the characters and the people, and you can relate to it from a humanistic perspective that was very revolutionary at his time. Which is why I think now a lot of people resonate a lot with Rav Hirsch. Again, how to deal with all these issues that today he was way ahead of his time in certain things. So.
But how could he say that like Torah like wouldn't last if it was going against the Torah that was like all the time?
So what he argued was that the Masorah needs to highlight certain aspects that he argues would appeal, that it's so appealing and so true, they just haven't heard of it that way. You follow? He says, not that, that is interesting. In many ways, and this is what was, it's a little bit of a contradiction, was he felt that if we strengthen certain aspects of our learning and our Jewish communities, it will draw in automatically other types of Jews. Right? So that you'd think, oh, Rav Hirsch should be for, quote-unquote, Kiruv. Why break away and have your own Jewish communal structure? Right? So Rav Hirsch got in big trouble. It really almost destroyed him. Because he went up against the entire secular Jewish world, and for lack of a better term, the more right-wing world. So he had no one defending him, but he held his ground. He had a small shul, a small community, and they weren't with. Yet you'd think that a person like that would want to join the masses. But that wasn't him. So in many ways, he said, "Let's." So he wouldn't accommodate. He was not an accommodate. He never felt he was accommodating. Never felt he was accommodating. So what he said was that the reason why the reform movement, quote unquote, is being successful with their numbers is simply because we're not broadcasting the message properly. And he said, by broadcasting the message, which is the real message, an authentic message, it would be so appealing to many people. That was like his understanding of it. Okay, there we go. That's week one, reverse. Fascinating, fascinating personality. I highly recommend. There's a great series on collective writings. I don't know if it's available in your local university library. Although, actually, it's probably available at U of T. Definitely your Jewish library is available. What was that?
I don't know where the library is.
Really?
It's an SLC.
What SLC? It's very relevant.
I want to. I want to.